belief in God, it's the only rational thing to do. I had very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason could never teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the less likely becomes the whole scenario in theory they use to explain its origin. The really amazing thing is that quantum physics shows that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and knowledge in ways biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here, welcoming you back to the program. The text and the Word of God I'd like to start out with are found in the book of Romans. I suppose if there were one book in the Bible that perhaps more than any other revealed the full scope, spiritually and theologically, of the human condition, it would be the book of Romans. And here we have inspired interpretation of so much of the spiritual meaning of biblical history. I mean, Paul talks about Adam. He talks about Abraham, Sarah, Jacob, Esau, Rebekah, Moses, David, the fall, Sinai, Jews, Gentiles, the law, grace, sin, love, death, judgment. First and foremost, he talks about Jesus and the plan of salvation. In fact, all that he talks about in the book, he really talks about in the context of Jesus and what Jesus has done for us. I don't think it would be exaggerating to say that over the course of history, one could probably fill a small library with the works written on the book of Romans alone. And I don't think one can exaggerate the influence of the history of this book on the church and certainly Protestantism. Now, the text I want to look at are in the beginning of the book. And really, in many ways, they help set the stage for all that Paul fleshes out in the ensuing chapters. It's Romans 1, 18 through 20. Heavy stuff. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Woo! You know, here Paul talks about what's a crucial theme in the book, in the Bible, in the book as a whole and in the Bible, and that is human sinfulness. The whole premise of the book rests upon the idea that of human corruption, but how Jesus came to solve the problem and to save us from the destruction that our corruption and sin would otherwise bring. That's what the cross and his death on the cross was to do, was to solve the problem of sin. But, you know, I want to focus on something else there in these texts. And this is the part that really is astonishing to me. What does he say here? He says that it's his claim that enough of the reality of the existence of God has been revealed through, he said, what has been made. That is, in the created world, that people will be without excuse. He seems to be saying that people can learn enough about the existence of God and the nature of God from the created world that they can be justly condemned on the day of judgment. Whew. You know, that's kind of heavy. That's a heavy claim. It really is. And it's not because these people are stupid. It's not because they can't understand it. Rather, it's that they are sinful and fallen, and in their sinful and fallen state, They suppress the truth. You know, I can understand that myself from personal experience. You know, I remember many years ago in college. I remember one time thinking in college, you know, I used to think about this stuff. And I remember one day thinking to myself, maybe there really is some big mama or some big daddy out there. Maybe there really might be a creator out there. But then when I thought that, I remember also, very funny, because I don't know anything, the commandments, the law, sin, guilt. But somehow I thought, if there really was a God, if there really was, and you know, I was in deep trouble because of how I lived. And so I pushed the idea of God out of me. I suppressed the truth and kept on, as they say, trucking. But fortunately, as they said too, God did an intervention for me, and here I am. Which is why now, thanks to the gospel, thanks to the promise of salvation, my eyes have been opened. And, well, they've been opened to the fact that, I know, and this might sound kind of hokey, but, you know, I see the reality of God everywhere. I really, really do. First, that anything at all, whatever it is, exists, is powerful evidence for a creator. Rocks, tea kettles, stars, iPhones, houses, quasars, iPhones, I said that already. Space, nothing came from itself. Nothing created itself. That's impossible. Because to create yourself, you already have to exist. And if you already existed, then you're not creating yourself because you're already there. No, nothing can create itself. Instead, whatever was created by something before it, and whatever was created was by something before that, and you go backward and backwards until you have to stop at something uncreated, something that always had been there. And the most logical thing had been there is the God, the one depicted in Scripture, the one being praised in Revelation, which says, "You are worthy, O Lord our God, to receive honor and glory and power, for you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being." I'm sorry, folks. I'm sorry, but the scientific fad, and yes, you people don't think it, but science can be very faddish, which claims, the fad that claims the universe arose from nothing, is mere ad hoc metaphysical speculation, guarded with all the epistemological privilege that science sanctimoniously awards itself. And what are they saying is that, yes, they're saying that the universe was created by nothing at all. You know, everybody's heard the name of Richard Dawkins. And I heard Richard Dawkins on the radio one time. He was interviewed in Washington, D.C. And I listened to it, and eventually I went back to the radio station. I found it online and got the quote. I want to listen to you to listen to this quote from Richard Dawkins. He goes, listen to this. Lawrence Krauss, my colleague, and we did a film together called The Unbelievers. And he has written a book called A Universe from Nothing. And he produces a physical theory, mathematically worked out, to show that you can get something from nothing. That nothing and nothing, in some strange way, cancels itself out to produce something. And quantum theory allows that to happen. Well, I'm humble enough to say I don't understand it, and I'm not arrogant enough to say that because I don't understand it, it can't be right. You know, folks, here we are, 400 years after the beginning of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, and we are being told that one nothing cancels out another nothing, and out of that, everything is created. I mean, come on. Oxford's Peter Adkins summed it up like this. How you like this quote? If we are to be honest, then we have to accept that science will be able to claim complete success only if it achieves what many think impossible. accounting for the emergence of everything from absolutely nothing. Whew. Sorry, folks, that's metaphysics. That's not physics. That's philosophy. That's not science. You know, centuries ago, there was a polymath named Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, and he famously asked a question which I think is about the broadest and grandest and largest question you could ask. And the question is simple. Why, he asked, is there something instead of nothing? Okay? Think about that for a minute. Why is there something instead of nothing? And I believe the most logical answer remains what it has always been. Because a self-existing and eternal existing God created everything that made. As John said about Jesus, through him all things were made, and without him was nothing made that has been made. That is, despite the firm declaration of many scientists, backed up by rigorous laboratory experiments and a few equations to boot, they argue that God doesn't exist and we are here by chance alone. Okay. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg expressed it like this. The most extreme hope for science is that we will be able to trace the explanation of all natural phenomena to final laws and historical accidents. It's crazy. 2,500 years of Western philosophical thought, and it climaxes now with the idea that everything rose from nothing and did so by accident as well. You know, makes me think a little bit of Richard Rorty, who was one of the most famous philosophers in the last half of the 20th century. And it was interesting, Rorty basically argued, he said, we're going the wrong way. We're never going to understand truth. It's silly to even try to figure out the truth. Because he said the whole concept of truth is misguided. He says all we could end up doing is, instead of trying to understand reality, all we ought to learn how to do is to try to cope with it. And again, I find it ironic. 2,500 years of Western philosophical thought, and what do we come to? We come to the idea that the universe arose from nothing by accident, and we can never understand it, so all we got to do is try to learn how to cope with it instead. I don't know, but somehow that doesn't sound too, that like we're made too much progress. Okay. Now, besides being told by the intelligentsia the opposite, I believe that design in the created world still declares a designer. Some of my favorite texts from the book of Job. Think about these. They're beautiful. But ask the animals, and they will teach you. Or the birds of the air, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. Or let the fish of the sea inform you. Which of all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In the hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. You know, in one sense, it's as if Job here is saying what Paul expressed many years later. It's like it's all there in the created world. You know, for centuries too, and I've talked about this before, philosopher David Hume in the 1700s wrote a book called Dialogue Concerning Natural Religion. And they argue that Hume, that they said that Hume proved that we can't extrapolate to a God or a designer from the created world. And he wrote this whole long thing. And in the end, what's his point? His point is, okay, if you walk along the ground and you see a watch, and you could see, the watch has a designer. You can't absolutely go from a watch having the designer to proving that God created the world, okay? But that wasn't the argument to begin with. You know, it's not absolute proof. It was never meant to be absolute proofs. All the only point was, you see design here, it implies a designer. You see design in the natural world, it implies a designer. That's all. It wasn't an absolute proof, and I still think, though, it's still powerful evidence. I mean, an iPhone, which looks design, acts design, reveals design in its innards and its outers, and works only through design, is, of course, design. But a human being, much more complex than an iPhone, which looks designed, acts designed, which reveals design in its inwards and outwards and outward stuff, and works only through design, is, of course, we're told by the world's best and brightest, not design. I'm sorry. Who am I to believe? Richard Dawkins, Charles Darwin, Christopher Hitchens, or my own eyes and my own brain, as well as Moses, Isaiah, Jesus, Paul, and John? You know, maybe I'm just not sophisticated enough. But when I see design in anything, whether it's something man-made or whether it's something in nature, it doesn't matter to me. Design points to a designer. Whether I happen to know that it was designer was in Silicon Valley, someone I could see face to face if need be, or whether he's somewhere in the cosmos and I can't see him. Either way, I'm sorry, design screams to me about a designer. And because I see design everywhere, I see the reality of God everywhere as well. Of course, there is the problem. There is the problem of evil. There is the problem of suffering. If you ever get a chance, and I did a whole show on this one time, called a scene from Fyodor Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, when two brothers are talking and the question of evil comes up, and one of the brothers brings up a point about how all the children suffering and all the suffering in the world, how could there be a God with all this suffering and so on, a loving God, an all-powerful, all-loving God? That's the question, isn't it? And though I don't have enough time to get into all that now, I simply want to say this, that there's nothing in the premise of an, this is the point, there's nothing in the premise of an all-loving, all-knowing, all-powerful God that deductively demands that there the non-existence of evil. It doesn't automatically follow. Instead, the great controversy forms a very powerful template and background that allows me to press on in faith, despite the painful evil that I admit rattles our souls. I can see the reality of God, even with the evil, because this evil shows me just how terribly wrong something has become, and that fits so well into the great controversy theme. I admit, when I look around, time and time again, I have to fall back on this meta-narrative, this great controversy meta-narrative, because it's found in the scripture, and it's the only thing that helps me to make sense of what really doesn't make sense at all. You know, I read an article one time. Oof, it's moving. Painful. I hope I don't break out in tears now as I talk about it. This woman wrote about her time as a teacher of poetry and prose to children dying of cancer at a cancer center in Texas. And I want you to listen to what this woman wrote. It's very moving. These children I write with die. No matter how much I love them, no matter how creative they are, no matter how many poems they have written, or how much they want to live. Whew. Almost every line was a zinger. And I mean, considering the topic, come on, kids and the cancer that kills them, how could her prose be anything but? Okay, but it was in the context of the suffering and these dying children that she had this one line that was so powerful and answers in its own way a lot. She was talking about the children dying, and she says, I was, like everyone else, trying to make sense of what is nonsensical. Nonsensical? That is, none of it makes sense. It cannot be rationally explained. There's no good reason for it. And yet, isn't it better that evil and children dying of evil not be nonsensical and not rational and logical and explicable? Otherwise, what? Good, logical, and harmonious reasons exist that these for why these kids lose limbs, suffer the trauma of chemo, endure horrific pain, sit in the hospital for years, and then die? Please, if there were good reasons for that, I'd rather not know them. However bad these tragedies are, it would seem to be worse if there was some logic to it, if there was sense to them. But there's not. That's why it's all nonsense. And again, that's why I go back to the much larger theme of the great controversy, the large cosmic battle between good and evil that Jesus won for us at the cross. That's the only template I use to help me, if not make sense of understanding of what's going on, at least put it in a larger perspective, one that gives me hope for a resolution. Sure, we have a million questions about a million things. But all still, this grand theme so greatly helps me keep it all together now. No matter how much remains unanswered and perhaps ultimately unanswerable. You know, it's like, can you imagine some woman gets to heaven? Look at it this way. Some woman gets to heaven and says, oh, Jesus, now I understand why my 10-year-old daughter was brutally sexually assaulted by a gang and then murdered before my eyes. Oh, now it all makes perfect sense. I wouldn't have had it any other way. Come on, that's sick. That's not how evil works. Evil is evil, and it's nonsensical, and there's no justification or excuse for it. And that's explained better in the Great Controversy template. Now, sure, someone could justifiably argue that with this temple, I'm working from a priori presuppositions about how the world works. Though, trust me, these might be presuppositions, but they're not a priori. But I got presuppositions. So what? Nothing can be believed without presuppositions. You can't believe in anything without certain assumptions you can't prove. No, at least these assumptions are what you use to test all that comes after. We all need assumptions. You can't do mathematics without assumptions. And you certainly can't do theology, or you certainly can't base a worldview on any theology without having assumptions. The key is to have the correct ones. And I'll never forget, very early as a believer, I struggled with the question once. With so many faiths and views out there, how do I know that Seventh-day Adventism is the truth? And I remember Bernie Molnar, one of my first contacts, he instantly answered. And Bernie said to me, well, it's certainly not unreasonable to think that with all the views out there, at least one of them is true. And I thought that was a great answer. That makes so much sense. I appreciated that answer back then. And today, 38 some years later, I still appreciate it and fall back on it because I believe it's built on a correct assumption. Yes, I do see the reality of God everywhere, even despite the evil. I look up at the sky and I see the reality of God. I look at rocks and I see the reality of God. I look at an iPhone and I see the reality of God. I look into my own soul, my own consciousness, and I see the reality of God. Because where else could this all have come from? I don't believe it all arose out of nothing, and I sure don't believe it rose out by chance. So where else but God? I think of Immanuel Kant, German philosopher's famous saying. Beautiful quote. Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily reflect upon them. The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. Pretty profound. And though I wouldn't phrase it as he did, the more often and steadily I reflect on everything that is, houses, butterflies, smartphones, it becomes almost all but undeniable to me that a creator exists. And with the grand revelation of him in the Bible, which includes powerful, powerful confirming evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I think I did a show a couple years back on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Man, that's powerful, rational, confirming evidence. And if Jesus was resurrected from the tomb, that proves the validity of the Christian faith. So I've got this grand revelation of God in the Bible, the powerful evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And then you've got the powerful confirming ministry of Ellen White and my own life-changing experience with Jesus and the assurance of salvation because of death in my behalf, his righteousness covering me and changing me. It's no wonder I believe in God, and it's even no wonder I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. What else could I be? You know, I want to return to Paul in Romans and those verses we looked at in the beginning. Think about what he's saying there. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's individual qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Notice, for what may be known about God is made plain to them. In other words, there's enough there that we should know. I don't have all the answers. I can't understand everything. Please, I have intellectual nightmares over the fact that -6 multiplied by -6 equals +36. And yet, -6 plus -6 plus -6 plus -6 plus -6 equals 36, equals -36. I go nuts trying to figure that out. How am I going to make sense of many other things? I can't, but who cares? I see God in everything, even the things I don't understand.